Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, into your town, into your home, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophony of conversation. Glad to be back with you once again. It is a gorgeous night here in the desert. Hands down, the nicest time of the year in the Mojave. Those triple digits are gone. You can walk outside without being burned to a cinder or bursting into flames or having blisters pop up on your skin. The nights are balmy. The days are warm and sunny. If you ever wanted to take a trip to Las Vegas or out into the desert, now's the time to do it. 50 years ago this weekend, my hometown had a special visitor, President John F. Kennedy, who made a stop to, at least in part, mend some political fences, but also to make a speech. He spoke at the Las Vegas Convention Center, and in that speech he spoke somewhat cryptically about some scientific work that was being done underway out in the Nevada desert that would make it possible for Americans to travel beyond the moon. He was speaking about work on a nuclear rocket engine, the NERVA program, it was called. After JFK was killed, the program lost its main champion, and it was eventually canceled a couple years later. Too bad, because that nuclear engine worked, and it would have made it. NASA had actually drawn up plans as early as 1969 to send a dozen astronauts to Mars. Would have made it more feasible for us to travel to Mars and perhaps further into space. There are many what-ifs when it comes to JFK. What if Dallas hadn't happened? Or what if the president had survived the assassination attempt that day? We're going to explore some of these possibilities tonight with Bryce Zabel. He's a TV producer and screenwriter. You might remember him from his NBC series Dark Skies. He's been my guest here a couple of times on this program and is always so well prepared to speak out about topics of mutual interest. You know what they are. Bryce has written a new novel about an alternate history of JFK and an alternate history of the nation, for that matter. The book is called Surrounded by Enemies, and I guess that title should give you a hint about where that book is headed. Coming up in the second half of tonight's program, we explore the what-ifs of JFK. If he'd survived Dallas, Bryce based his version of the story on solid historical facts, and I think you'll enjoy the conversation we have planned. On the Coast website tonight, two videos of note in this context. Right under the biographical info about Bryce Zabel, you'll see a link to a short film that he produced. It's pretty clever stuff. It's a news talk show, a roundtable for reporters on what would be the 50th anniversary of JFK surviving the events in Dallas. These reporters are going back and forth and kind of reviewing what had happened to our country after that. It's a nice warm-up, I think, to the interview we'll have later tonight. Also on the website is my report, my news report for KLAS-TV about JFK's final visit to Las Vegas and his particular interest in that nuke rocket program that was later canceled. It was certainly on his mind 50 years ago this weekend when he made his last visit to our town here. But before we get to that, we've got another powerhouse guest and a topic that you Coast listeners can't get enough of. Former lawman David Politis is here with new information, new cases to chill you to your bones. I'm talking about these strange disappearances in national forests and parks. Cases that just don't make any sense and are flat out weird. As you might know, Dave has been my guest several times in the past, and I know that you listeners are just as baffled as I am when it comes to this ongoing mystery. Hundreds of people have vanished, most of them in these couple of dozen of clusters around the country, under very unusual circumstances. Those few who've been found are either dead or they're unable to speak about where they went and what happened to them, though a handful, just a couple of them, have given tantalizing and perplexing clues about what went on while they were missing. Dave's books, Missing 411, now three volumes in all. And the cases keep coming in part because you listeners have responded and have forwarded additional information from your home states, your hometowns. The response from authorities, including the National Park Service, is underwhelming, befuddling. It's like a great big dull thud. They're remarkably uninterested in this mystery, or they're doing their best to pretend they're not interested. We'll explore some new, baffling cases and new attention that Dave has received in recent weeks. That's coming up momentarily. Webmaster Lex and I have put together an assortment of news stories from the past week or so. You can find these stories in the NAPS News section on the Coast website, and we'll talk about a few of them later if we get the chance. I will also strive to make sure there is some time set aside for you to ask questions of both of my guests tonight. And with that, let's not dally any further. We're going to take our first break and come right back with David Politis and the latest Missing 411 Cases and Mysteries. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. If you've heard any of my previous interviews with Dave Politis about his three-volume books, Missing 411, you don't need much of a buildup. This is great stuff. It goes right to the heart of what we cover on this program, and I'll tell you, this third volume, we are proud to have played a role in helping to get the word out to a larger audience about Dave's work. The third volume, North America and Beyond, got one heck of a review from someone who knows a good mystery when he sees one. Whitley Strieber, who's been our guest a few times on the program and has sold millions of his own books, said, "This is one of the greatest and most disturbing mysteries of our time. The most comprehensive books on the subject ever written. Sobering, chilling, and essential reading," he called it. That's pretty high praise and completely justified, in my opinion. David Politis is a former lawman who first appeared on this program years ago to talk about his excellent books about the Bigfoot mystery. That work led him to his current pursuit, and it's really not clear where else it might lead because we still don't know what's behind it. Dave, great to have you back on the show.
Hey, thanks a lot, George.
You're getting a lot of attention these days, and I think it's long overdue. I mean, in addition to the review from Whitley, you were featured in an article in the Huffington Post. You've done a bunch of radio shows. I know that there was this article. I was utterly amazed to see that there's an article written by you for the MUFON Journal because, and I say it this way, not because it's not justified, but because UFO folks over the years have been pretty careful about avoiding any kind of cross-pollinization with other mysteries. They like their aliens and saucers to stay in a neat little category all their own, not get mixed up with other weirdness. So how did that happen?
Well, that's an interesting story. The editor for the MUFON Journal had received the initial narrative I wrote about this, and he took it to the board of directors for the exact reasons that you explained, and he wanted them to review it and see if it fit. And he said it was overwhelming that they wanted it in, and they were going to push stories off of the front page for the 2 months and put it in right now. So it came out just within the last couple of days. And he said that they're having discussions to make this one of the priority items that they maybe should focus on moving forward and not ignore it.
Well, that's great because, I mean, I know that field pretty well, and those guys can be very stodgy. Those guys and gals, I should say, could be very stodgy about expanding the parameters of the mysteries that they explore. How does this fit in, though? I read the article. I don't want to give the whole thing away. And for those who don't subscribe to the journal, maybe you can give us sort of a synopsis how it fits in with the UFO mystery.
Well, I'm not trying to put a square peg in a round hole, but we read so many different journals, you know, prospecting journals, MUFON journals, everything. Every once in a while, you come across a coincidence that's just too much to ignore. And I didn't draw any conclusions to this. I just brought them to this coincidence that they can't ignore. And how it came about is several months ago, one of the researchers in MUFON went to an area called Cape Fear, North Carolina. And I think something that we've written about in the past is that these incidents happen near locations where their names will strike you as unusual. Mm-hmm. Devil's Peak, Cape Fear. When I saw that right away, I thought, well, that's kind of weird. Wonder how that got its name. And this investigator wrote this article about an incident where two men and a boy were fishing along the Cape Fear River. It's kind of near an area of Hope Mills, North Carolina. And they separated briefly, and this young boy happened to see some orbs, some lights in the trees. as he was walking alone. And it turns out that this man, who was separate from him at the time, saw the same thing, and this was his dad. And as they got further apart, the boy ended up seeing what he described as two humanoids on the ground around this fire pit, kind of examining the area. And above it was this light hovering above them, maybe 200 yards or less when he first saw it, and then he kind of converged on it and got this close-up of these humanoids. Well, the boy and his dad got together. He explained what he saw. They decided to go home, and they went to an area about 16 miles west of Roseboro, North Carolina, where their house was at, and it's called Gray's Creek. And they went home. At about 1:30 that morning, the MUFON investigator used these two words I've never heard before. He said a vibrational tremor came over the house, and something was above the house, and it woke the dad. The dad went outside, and the dog was already outside, but when he opened the door, their dog took off on a dead run into the woods, and he went into the woods to look for the dog. Well, there was a lot of things that came out of this, and MUFON sent a special team out to interview these people, and the dad and the son agreed to go under reverse hypnosis to figure out what happened, and then the father ended up agreeing to take a polygraph exam on it, too, and they ended up passing the polygraph, and during the regression, the father, it turns out, was abducted from this riverside setting when he saw this orb and these lights. So he's abducted, goes up to a ship. The specifics are a bit unclear, but he confirms it in that polygraph. Now step back for a second. In our work, we deal with rural disappearances with a set of criteria. And that criteria can be people with disabilities, people that disappear with canines, missing or found, and they disappear near bodies of water. And sometimes they disappear in one of the 34 geographical clusters we've identified in North America. Inclement weathers associated with the disappearances. Swamps, briar patches play a predominant role. In a vast majority of the cases, these occur in the late afternoon or evening. If the missing are found alive, majority of the times, they either refuse to discuss the incident or they don't remember the incident. And a vast majority of the times, they're found semi-conscious or unconscious. And the last one is many of the missing are found in areas previously searched, sometimes as much as 50 times. Sometimes they're found on the main trail coming back to the search and rescue locations. Last one I forgot to mention was berries are inextricably related somehow with the disappearance. Sometimes their kids found eating them. Sometimes the people are out berry picking and they vanish. Going back to this instance, there were a couple of cases, and this is highly, highly unusual, that two small boys disappear from the same town. One of the things that I explain in the books is it's very hard to understand how this phenomena was discovered because there's usually 20 or 30 years sometimes between the disappearances if they're in the same area. So it's almost like a generation of, say, law enforcement has already cycled through, and the next group in isn't going to remember the last time it happened. The first case, Roseboro, North Carolina, a 2-year-old boy named Bruce Sharon. On February 27, 1976, he was at his grandfather's farm 3 miles west of Roseboro, rural setting, and he was in the front yard with a German Shepherd puppy playing. This is really in the middle of nowhere. There's a river nearby, but it's a farming area. The aunt that was watching Bruce went in the house for just a few minutes. She comes out, and Bruce and the dog are gone. And there's fields around. She can see for a long ways, and she's not seeing anything. Right away, she calls the Sampson County Sheriff's, and they send the 82nd Airborne. They send the National Guard. There's hundreds of deputies, volunteers. The North Carolina Bureau of Investigation gets sent out on the third day. And it was called one of the largest efforts to find anybody in the county's history. 1,200 people searched for over a week. Bloodhounds, rescue crews, paratroopers. It was an unbelievable response. And After about 3 or 4 days, the officers that were investigating Bruce's disappearance started to bring up the word kidnapping. And in a large percentage of the cases that I describe, kidnapping or abduction is used by law enforcement. But the reality of it is, if you think about it in a common sense way, that standard form of kidnapping or abduction would have been extremely difficult and risky to do because you're in such a remote area, and most of the time the people that were the guardians of these kids were in that immediate area. Well, Bruce's dad was a specialist in the Army, and a lot of people ask me, are these kids the victims of people in the service, or is there some strong religious affiliation? This is one of those times where his dad was a specialist at Fort Benning. He was granted a 15-day leave to come home and search. Like a long, long story, there was never any evidence of him found, and there was a 2-week search. Foul play was thought of, but that was the essential end, and he was never found. That was Bruce Sherrin, February 27th, 1976. Now, fast forward 24 years and 8 months in Roseboro, North Carolina, this time 1 mile west of Roseboro. So these two places were 2 miles apart from each other and 16 miles away from where these people were abducted. This boy's name was Tristan Buddy Myers. And if you ever want to read a story about a kid that had a rough life, this is the one. And the story goes is that Tristan was the son of an exotic dancer, and she couldn't take care of him, and it went to the grandparents. When he was a young, young boy, he was playing in the driveway, and the grandfather accidentally ran him over, broke his leg and ran over part of his head. He recovered fully, and the courts gave him to an aunt and an uncle. And the aunt and the uncle eventually ended up taking care of the boy out in Roseboro. And eventually, Buddy disappeared in October 5th, 2000. His mom died in an auto accident in 2004. So when he disappeared, he was living in a residence with his aunt and his uncle. His uncle was at work. The aunt was one of these kind of people that really took care of the kids and was worried about them. So she had an alarm installed in the house, a loud buzzer system, that if the door ever opened, she'd know right away that Buddy was going outside. Well, they went to the store. They came back this day, October 5th, from the store. And Buddy was in the house playing with their small dog. And she was laying on the family room sofa. And Buddy laid down on the floor. The dog laid down. She watched him go to sleep. And she took a small 10-15 minute nap. 10 minutes after she thought she fell asleep, her cell phone rang. It was her husband saying, "Hey, how you doing? What's going on?" As she wakes up, she looks at the floor, and the dog and Buddy are gone. She looks through the house because she knows the buzzer hasn't gone off. Isn't in the house. She goes outside. They had another small puppy in a small yard surrounded by a very tiny fence. That puppy was gone, the puppy in the house was gone, and Buddy was gone. And again, another huge search. On day 5 of that search, something strange happened. The chihuahua that was playing with Buddy in the house, a dog named Buck, came back into the yard. It kind of reinvigorated everybody, and they thought, wow, okay, well, this is a good sign. Well, the dog had been fed, it was clean, and it didn't have the appearance that it was in the outdoors for 3 days, five days. Nothing else happened until day 10, and then the puppy that was outside returns. Same thing, good condition, fed, everything was good. 2-week response on this, 1,000 people, bloodhounds, everything you can imagine was thrown at this, never found. Now, the coincidences in this are, both these occurred in a rural area west of Roseboro. They were both in the presence of their aunt. Something unusual here. In a lot of these disappearances, these kids disappear while they're with a relative, not with their parents. Both these kids were playing with dogs when they left, and that's another thing. A lot of these kids that we research disappear with canines. One dog in each of these incidents, at least one, returned to the residence after the disappearance. Both of these kids came from broken homes, or They came from a home and were living with a relative temporarily.
It's almost like they're throwaway kids or something.
Yep. Law enforcement considered kidnapping in each case. 82nd Airborne participated in each search, and there was never any evidence found in either one of the events. The last thing, the important thing, the geographical similarity that each case. And the most unusual, I think, aspect of each of one of these cases is in Buddy's case, the buzzer didn't go off.
Dave, I'm going to have to stop the story there. It's just when it's getting good, we need to take a break. Back with more of these chilling stories from Dave Politis and 411, Missing 411, Coast to Coast AM continues. Miles from Nowhere is where many of the victims in Dave Politis' books, Missing 411, found themselves. And as we will hear coming up, there's no way that we can figure out that some of these kids in particular could travel the distances that they traveled. In those instances where bodies were found, or in a few instances where some kids were found alive. I mean, they were up on tops of mountains. They would traverse vast distances without shoes. It makes no sense. When we come back, we'll continue the story about Buddy and his dog, that disappearance, and then get into a couple of the characteristics that disqualify some of the prosaic explanations for these disappearances in national parks and forests. Stay with us. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. We're back with Dave Politis. His latest book, Missing 411, cases focusing on North America and beyond. Dave, you want to continue the story about Buddy and his dog?
Sure. And let's just recap. So between the two disappearances of the boys, it was 24 years, 8 months. The last disappearance, Buddy, disappeared October 5th, 2000. Fast forward to what brought us here today is this two adults and a boy on Cape Fear River. And that was 13 years after Buddy disappeared. And if you look at the 600-plus cases that we've studied, that separation by time is important. And let's just say if they had three disappearances in the city of Roseboro within, let's say, a 7 or 8 year span, that would be enough to raise the ire of law enforcement and local press that there was a serious incident going on. Now, as someone who's read thousands of these reports, I don't know of another case of a city like Roseboro where two boys, you know, young boys like this, have disappeared without a trace. Usually in these cases, maybe 3 or 4 years down the line, they'll find a skeleton. More likely than not, within a couple months after they disappear, a canine trained to track cadavers or that odor coming off of a dead body, that would find it. Again, nothing's found in these cases. So what's the important points here to us? Where were the dogs? They came back clean, healthy, and fed. So where were they for that 5 to 10 days that they were gone? Why didn't the buzzer go off in the house when he disappeared, but he disappeared? And probably one of the issues that obviously we're talking about is, could you just ignore the coincidence that 16 miles away, this guy passes a polygraph saying he's been abducted?
I commend the MUFON Journal for being willing to explore this, you know, because it does open them up probably to criticism, but it's courageous to go ahead and follow the evidence, to follow the evidence that you've accumulated. And I know you've been very careful, very meticulous about not giving an answer, not saying what your pet theory is, or even giving any kind of indication at all what you think of it. But by putting this article in the MUFON Journal, you're making comparisons to what we know as alien abduction stories. I mean, it's inevitable that people would say, hey, maybe there's a connection there.
Well, I think it would be negligent on our part not to identify the coincidence. And I put a list together this morning. I was going through all the emails we had about some of the things that people have focused on in the past and said, hey, Dave, you've nailed it. You guys have really exposed what's going on here. It's obvious. And here's some of the things that people have said. It's dog man, it's reptilians, it's aliens, it's Bigfoot, Sasquatch, skinwalkers, serial killers in the woods, Mothman, and a list of a variety of crypto creatures. And if you start thinking about all these things, it's hard to be an expert in all those areas. And what I tell people is that your mind kind of goes where that comfort level's at and where your knowledge base is at. And that's one thing that we try not to do, is we try to read as much literature from these various areas that we can, because it's a complex issue. And there are no easy answers here. And I've never had anybody say, oh, yeah, after they've read the book, you know, it's, well, the strangest one we had was, is somebody said, well, it's obvious that there's some park rangers that are serial killers that are in their parks. And if you look at the number of years that are between some of these disappearances, there's 100 years in some areas, 120 years. So that throws out that theory.
Well, there are comparisons. I mean, there are similarities to the stories we've heard over the years about alien abductions. Some of the cases you described, especially in the first two books of Missing 411, it's as if these victims are plucked out of the sky and dropped somewhere, you know, as if by saucers or eagles or pterodactyls or something, right?
Oh, no. And some of the one of the things when we first got started with this, we try to learn as much as we can about search and rescue and setting grids and their parameters that they use. And there's a couple books out there that tell you, okay, if a child is between the age of 1 and 3, you know, they'll be found at 95% of the time in 2.8 miles or less from the point they're last seen. Well, one of the things that we found is that the majority of the cases we work blow those numbers completely out of the water. There's a couple of cases that I talk about in this recent book, where a couple of girls disappear. One was found, I think, 75 miles away. They were on foot. She was dead. And then her sister was found, I think, 12 or 15 miles away. And these were fairly young girls. But then there's also cases right on the fringe of Yosemite where a 2-year-old boy disappears, and he climbs not one mountain. He climbs one mountain, goes down the backside of another, and up another over 3,000 feet for a 2-year-old kid. And there's a lot of these examples. Just like you said, anyone with any rational sense knows that they're not going to get there on their own, especially if you have kids. And, you know, kids are going to take normally 95% of the time the path of least resistance, downhill.
We haven't covered this yet about the factors that you use to sort of exclude cases that come your way, because I can hear people's minds clicking, oh, hi, it's a serial killer, it's pot farmers out there in the national forest, It's mountain lions, it's bears. I mean, you're pretty meticulous about weeding those out. And cases that would meet those kind of characteristics, you don't consider them. You don't put them into your database, right?
Absolutely. And we exclude a lot just because of that. So first of all, if there's any type of mental illness or suicide thoughts that go with the case, we don't work it. If there's any possibility that the child or the adult might have been washed away in a river or drowned in a lake, we won't work it. And the reason for that is that you want to take the ambiguity away if it's one of those cases. And it's real easy to pull the trigger on one of those cases and say, oh, yeah, that's what's happened. But if you just eliminate them, and I know we're probably eliminating some cases that could be here, the reality of it is it's just our safety mechanism. One of the other big things, any incident where it could have been an animal attack, we won't work it. And I've heard a lot of people discuss this and say, well, you know, a mountain lion running 20 miles an hour can knock a kid out of his socks. But when a mountain lion or a bear attack a human, there's usually some carnage there. There's hair, there's a scene in the dirt, there's blood. There's a lot that goes on there that can be readily identifiable for somebody who knows what they're looking for. And when search and rescue gets on the scene, it's one of the first things they're looking for. When trackers get on a scene, it's one of the first things they're looking for, coupled with the type of tracks that are in that area from a type A predator, bear, mountain lion, etc. So if that was ever thought of, then we throw that case out.
How do you rule out, for example, serial killers or some Mexican mafia cartel growing pot in a national forest, something like that?
That's a good question. And we get that brought up a lot. If it was somebody in a meth lab or somebody growing weed, I can guarantee that that would have been spotted and they would have been arrested and the seizure would have been made, because you've got to remember, you got hundreds, sometimes thousands of people combing these mountains, going miles away looking for these people. And that's never happened in any of these cases. Now, a serial predator, let's say, meets someone on a trail in a national forest. There's such a high likelihood that people in a national forest are going to be armed in some way or another. It's a very, very high-risk maneuver. And if it did happen, what are you going to do with that person? You're not going to carry them away very far because people weigh a lot. And when they bring a canine in to track, the canine's going to track the scent that's emitting off of the person they're looking for. One of the things that is a criteria on ours is that a canine can't track scent on these cases 99.5% of the time. Sometimes they get put on the track where the person was last seen. Sometimes the canines walk in a circle and lay down. Sometimes they walk around and the handler will say, I've never seen that before. My dog wasn't even interested. Or my dog, I've heard this before, my dog acts afraid. So it's very unusual behavior because these tracking dogs live for this stuff. And if anyone's ever been around one or helped train one, they know, I mean, they're going out of their minds. They want to do this. They're excited. Not in these cases.
You mentioned about the dog connection on the other side of it, where the two cases on the East Coast where the dogs disappeared with the boys and then came back. Is the dog connection as part of the disappearance? Does that happen fairly frequently? I know I saw a couple of other cases in the book where dogs are involved and the dogs vanish as well. Is it always that the dogs come back, or they mostly disappear as well with the child or the individual?
I'd say 90 to 95% of the time they come back. A lot of the times the dog, if the child's found, a lot of times the dog is found with the child. But then there are times where the parents will say, hey, the dog and my child are inseparable, and the dog will come back. They try to get the dog to go back and help them look, and the dog won't go back. And the parents say, hey, I can't believe I'm seeing this. Other times, the dogs will go back, and they'll take them to a spot, and the child's not there. And then a couple days later, the child's found on the main trail, say, search and rescue are looking for the child on. And how that child got there, nobody understands.
And had been searched 50 times.
Right.
There's a case that jumps out at me in the new book, The Missing 411 North America and Beyond, because it happened right near, maybe a couple of miles from where I was born. It's in New Jersey. And it's not exactly the same as the other cases. This didn't happen in some national forest. But it's perplexing, and it, too, involves a dog, the little girl in the closet. Tell me that story.
So that's an unusual case for a couple of reasons. And the reason we included it is because of the house backs up to kind of a wildlife area and a creek area. And a lot of the cases that we work involve creeks and rivers and kids either going missing while in that creek, and I don't mean drowned or washed away, or later on they're found there. And as many of the listeners have identified to us, and we get it, is that a creek, especially a dry creek bed or a river that's shallow, if you walk up that creek or you walk down that creek in that river, the chances of anyone finding any footprints or tracks are almost zero. So that's a very efficient way to move through an area and not be identified. This girl, Mary Jane Barker, 3 years old, she was playing in her backyard on February 25th, 1957, in the morning hours. And she was in a place called Bellmawr, B-E-L-L-M-A-W-R, New Jersey, and it's just across the river from Philly. And her mom came out, looked at her. She's playing in the backyard with her Cocker Spaniel. Her mom comes out 5-10 minutes later. The dog's gone. The girl's gone. And she can't believe it because she thought she had everything locked up solid. And she looked in the back, the creek, didn't see anything. Started to get some neighbors together. They searched. They quickly called the police. The police come out. And essentially 3 days of searching, and the police start to bring up this word kidnapping again. Now the dog's gone and the girl's gone. So they start to spread out more, and they bring in some professional trackers. And on that fourth day, they think that they see an area in that creek bed, and they think they see some tracks of a large man with a dog and a child. They're not sure, but they think so. So we're going into the sixth day now, and this is an area that's not really developed yet. There's a few houses scattered in the area, not a lot. And two blocks away, people were building a new house. Now, you got to remember, the area out probably a mile has been searched 5 or 6 times. These houses that are being built have been searched 5 or 6 times. Well, the house was going up for sale, and a mom and a daughter, unknown to the victim's family, was inside this new house looking at it. And this little girl opens up a closet door, and Mary Jane's dog bolts out of the closet and jumps on the little girl. And inside the closet is Mary Jane, deceased. So they call in the sheriff, they do an autopsy, and it shows that Mary Jane hadn't eaten anything for 6 days. But the strange thing about this was the police chief confirmed that that house in that area had been searched 3 times minimum. And the very odd thing is that there was no excrement inside that closet from a dog or her. And the workers had said they had been in that house almost every day, and they never heard any sounds, and they never heard any barks, nothing. So the coroner thought initially, well, she just must have been in there, and he can't explain why there's no excrement. They actually brought in a veterinarian, and the veterinarian found out that the dog hadn't been trained about where to defecate or where not to, and he had absolutely no explanation why there was no excrement from the dog or anything in that closet. So the question comes up, was she in that closet for 6 days? Was the dog in that closet for 6 days? And if they weren't, where were they, and how long had they been in there?
And how searchers would have missed them as well.
Well, that's a common theme that you'll see, and trust me, I am not saying that the searchers are missing these people. I don't believe it, because in a large percentage of the cases we turn here is that people make the statement, but we search this area 5 times. We search this area 10 times. We search this area 50 times, and they weren't there. They come back the 51st time. There they are.
It's as if the victims are taken. They're taken somewhere else, and then they're brought back and sort of dumped.
Kind of the way it appears.
Tell me this. Are you making any headway? We can talk about the National Park Service a little bit later if you want, but just to summarize our previous interviews, you've presented a lot of this evidence about clusters, in particular in national parks. The National Park Service is not only uninterested, but hostile to you. I was wondering if you've made any headway with local police agencies who are investigating missing persons cases. It seems to me they would be maybe more sympathetic or more willing to hear what you had to say.
And many of them are. But you got to understand the mentality of the police. And I think the best example how to understand what we're doing is in this latest article in the Huffington Journal, the reviewer said, what's happening here is not going to jump out at you in the first 15 or 30 pages. But after you read 10 to 15 cases, you're going to see a pattern evolve, and then you're going to have this moment where the light goes on in your head and you say, I get it.
Right.
And it's hard to explain in an hour or two, but I can tell you, and I'm sure you realize it, George, that there's circumstances in these cases that you can't ignore that kind of run right underneath all of them. And when you start to look at the clusters and the timing of the clusters and the disappearances and the facts, you start to realize, wow, this is like profiling. This is like what the FBI does when they're trying to find a serial killer. They're looking for these underlying elements so they can tie these cases together. That's kind of what we're doing here. As far as law enforcement, it's very hard to explain to them what we're doing other than we're just investigating missing people. Some of the jurisdictions are super, super helpful. Others, they're kind of questioning sometimes whether you're going to out them for doing a bad job, and sometimes they hold the information back. A few of them, you can't believe how much information they'll give you. A few of these cases, they gave us crime scene photos on them. And I work with a guy named Harvey Pratt from the Oklahoma Bureau of Investigation. He used to be their director. He's a forensic artist, one of the smartest guys in the world I've ever known that's an investigator. And we spend days sometimes kicking this information around because it doesn't make sense. And yes, these agencies are helping us, but the Park Service, if anything, they've gone the other way. They don't want to help. And interestingly, and I think it was an ironic moment, maybe a couple months ago, I was at a national park with a friend of mine, and we happened to walk into one of their rural locations, and here's three guys sitting around this table.
Hey, Dave, I'm going to have to interrupt. I'm sorry, that's a bad point, but I think people will hang on to hear what the rest of that story is. But the music from Pink Floyd tells us we need to take a break. We'll continue this conversation with Dave Politis and talk about new information about clusters of disappearances that he has found right after this on Coast to Coast AM.